my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road, many kinds I've met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and I go, seconds tick the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm Doug Bennett, your host. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the listen button. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves, so once again, go to kkrn.org and click on the donate button to support our efforts. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite your comments and questions. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. If you'd like to just send me a comment about the show, you can send me an email at unspun@kkrn.org, U-N-S-P-U-N at kkrn.org. Co-hosting with me today is Pamela Spoto, educator, poet, and host of Late Night Poetry Jam here on KKRN. Pamela, thanks for being here with us today and helping co-host the show.
Good morning.
That was short and sweet. So,
and thank you.
And yes, thanks for being here. Pamela also has been one of the big supporters of Black History Month in the past and at the college, and has a special interest in peace and justice. So that's why I invited her to co-host with us today. Our guest on the phone is Norm Stamper. Norm Stamper is a 34-year veteran police officer who retires as Seattle's chief of police in 2000. He is currently a speaker for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. That's LEAP. And it's a 5,000-member organization with 75,000 public supporters, representing cops, judges, prosecutors, FBI, and DEA agents, prison wardens, and public supporters who now want to legalize and regulate all drugs after witnessing the horrors and injustices of the war on drugs. In addition to serving as Seattle's top cop, Norm led the San Diego Mayor Pete Wilson's Crime Control Commission. Norm is the author of Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. And I will put links to that. That's at www.normstamper.com. Breaking Ranks talks to the dark side of police work in America. And it's an important book that we all could look at. So let's see here. Norm was also, in his own words, the chief or city police chief during the 1999 so-called battle in Seattle, the clash between anti-globalization protesters and my police officers. I realize now that the way we looked and the way we behaved provoked and exacerbated the violence. My decision to authorize the use of so-called hard gear, black uniforms with ballistic helmets and face shields, and the use of chemical agents in our interactions with nonviolent, non-threatening World Trade Organization demonstrators heightened tensions and put everyone, cops and citizens, at greater risk. The militarization of the WTO protest did untold damage to our efforts to build a positive, trusting partnership with our community, end quote. His recent article in The Guardian is entitled, Nothing Works in Ferguson's, Here's How to Fix a Police Force, Dash, and Punish Cops, talks to the mishandling of demonstrators in Missouri. Let's welcome Norm Stamper. Norm, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Thank you very much, Doug. It's good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's been a few years. We were talking about that. The last time that we talked was just right after the treatment of the Occupy protesters in New York. And what I guess my opening question, looking at Ferguson and what's going on, even since we've talked, and the militarization of the police there, my question to you is, have we in America learned anything from the lessons that you tried to teach us after your experience in Seattle?
Evidently not. When I was watching the coverage of what was happening in Ferguson, I was, number one, appalled by some of the behavior, but also very saddened that lessons learned in Seattle in 1999 were not adopted during the Occupy movement and certainly have not been adopted in cities like Ferguson. So what we have is a repetition, a very depressing repetition of the mistakes that I made in 1999.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I wanted to ask you a question about perception, people's perception of the police, but also police's perception of people of color. I teach, and in my classes, often white students have a totally different attitude about, you know, the police protecting and serving, and African Americans and people of color believe they need, excuse me, to be protected from the police. Excuse me. And I'm just wondering how, part of Ferguson and the way the media handles it has to do with perception. Doug asked the question, have we learned anything? And I'm wondering about how people are going to learn about situations like this if the media distorts the information, if black people are seen as the problem. What do you think about that? How can we change perceptions?
I think you change perceptions, and I couldn't agree more with the thinking behind that question. We have a huge gulf in this country between white and black.
Yes.
And the Pew poll that came out just two or three days after the height of the tension in Ferguson shows that 88% of African Americans believe that the relationship is ruptured and that it's much in need of repair, and only about 37% of whites have that view. So we have this huge chasm between white America and black America. And if we're ever to achieve a point at which we appreciate our differences rather than fear them and react negatively to them, it's going to take a shift in perception. And that shift does not come about spontaneously. It comes about as a result, I think, of a choice. Making a decision that we're going to have that long-deferred, honest conversation about race in this country. You know, generation after generation, you'll hear the same language from pundits and people like me and others who are saying, we've never really had an honest, sustained conversation about race that would lead to differences in perception. And of course, one of the fascinating aspects of perception is you can see the world one way, I can see it another. Both of us could be right, both of us could be wrong, one right, the other wrong, but it doesn't matter. What really matters is, I think, that the consequences of one's perception are always real. If I perceive the police as unworthy of my trust, I will behave accordingly.
Yes, and that is so true. And, you know, maybe I'm just kind of jumping in here. I'm wondering how the police, in terms of their training, I would like to think that we can have law enforcement, police officers that are well-educated, intelligent, with good hearts, that have compassion. Other people might think that they need to be hardened, you know, and tough. But how do we train officers to be able to relate to people of color? That seems to be an issue as well. Instead of seeing the black man as the thug, you know, the dangerous one. Are there classes? I mean, is there training that really deals with the kind of sensitivity towards diversity, or is this something we really need to work on?
Yes, no, and maybe. I say that not as a consultant, which seems to be a common response from consultants, which I do occasionally, by the way. But I think what happened in the 1960s in this country was a real wake-up call for American law enforcement. and city governments and county governments and state and the federal government. And we said, well, we clearly have neglected the training of our police officers in, pick a title, cross-cultural relations, race relations, community relations, or even public relations. We have taught cultural competency. We've taught diversity training, sensitivity training. Training is essential, but is absolutely not enough. What really does need to happen, I'm convinced, is a radical restructuring of the institution of American policing. It is paramilitary in nature. It is bureaucratic in nature. It predictably gives rise to a police culture that is antagonistic toward the community it serves. And the more militaristic we've become, I still say we a lot. I've been out of the business now for 14 years, but some things you just don't turn off. But we have become increasingly militaristic, certainly with the advent of the drug war, but particularly after 9/11. The federal government has not helped. In fact, it's hurt a lot. It has colluded with this militaristic impulse in American law enforcement by doling out military and military-grade equipment and weaponry to local law enforcement. So we're headed exactly down the wrong path, as far as I'm concerned. We need that training, but we also need to restructure American policing.
You know, I want to break back in here and kind of focus on the culture of police departments, and this is something I've seen locally, having worked with the ACLU as their representative and sat down with local police. And there is a culture, and I saw this in Ferguson, and maybe you can enlarge on this, Norm. But what I saw was immediately the police culture came and encircled the policeman that shot Michael Brown in every way possible to insulate him and to protect him. And they even went to the point of vilifying the victim, you know, who was obviously shot with, he had no weapon, shot 6 to 10 times, most likely with his hands in the air. So maybe you can talk to how that works within the police departments, how they maintain that culture so nothing else can get in and change it?
You know, I can try to do that without turning too sociological, or for that matter, psychological, although those two disciplines do provide a lot of insight, I think, into what happens to workplace cultures of people like police officers. And every occupation has a workplace culture. Let's be real clear about that. But when you're wearing a uniform, when you're packing a weapon and wearing a badge, and you are imbued by society with authority, the sanctioned right to order the actions of others, and you are given the authority to use force as necessary, up through and including excessive force, if necessary, things happen to you. Excuse me, as a part of belonging to a family, a professional family of people who do that same work. The community doesn't understand us. I hate going to parties because all I hear is complaints about a ticket that somebody got, or some other officer throwing his weight around, or so on and so forth. I understand my fellow officers. They face the same working conditions that I do. They know that sudden violent death is an occupational hazard for police officers. It is, by the way, one of the safer occupations when compared to mining and agriculture. And if you want a really dangerous job, you go out crabbing in the Bering Sea in the middle of winter. There are other jobs that are much more dangerous, but there's something different about the dangers attached to police work. And Jerome Skolnick, from at the time at Berkeley, wrote a book called Justice Without Trial. It's a classic, which means it's been around forever. And in it, he said there are conditions that shape the working personality, as he described it, of today's police officers. He was talking back in the late 60s. He could just as easily be talking about today. And that is, we have given police officers the task of exercising authority in the most legitimate sense, in the interest of public safety and neighborhood health, and then we have made their work dangerous, or at least we have elevated the perception of danger. So here's what you have if I can use the expression kid, in a 21-year-old kid, which was my age when I became a cop, who's given this awesome authority. It's literally peace and freedom, life and death, discretionary decision-making authority. We've given them the badge, the gun, and we've told them enforce the law. And Skolnick says if there are ever two words that should never show up in the same job description, it's danger and authority. So what that does, I think, is place an enormous demand on society, on communities, on civic leaders, community activists, and, of course, local government, and particularly the police, to provide the best possible selection process so that we get officers who are capable of doing this tough job, and we provide education and training second to none. It needs to be experiential. You need to feel what you need to sort of take note of what your body is feeling and how you are reacting to stressful situations in simulation before you ever face that on the street. So an excellent combination of classroom training and experiential training is just critical to the education and training of police officers. Then we get to where the rubber hits the road, as the cops would say, and that is the tendency on the part of senior officers, seasoned, been there, done that, who will tell new officers just fresh out of the academy, forget what they taught you in the academy. You're in the real world now, son, and here's the way it goes. And that's when, in too many departments, too many police officers are picking up the wrong habits. And once they've been established and they're part of that family where they feel that they really belong, it's real hard to break through to them. But it's necessary.
Let me interrupt you just to let our listeners know that you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Co-hosting today is Pamela Spoto. Our guest is Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle and author of Breaking Rank. Let me say that again, Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. We're talking about militarization of U.S. law enforcement and ongoing police violence and bigotry. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. We invite your questions and comments. This is your chance to talk to a real law professional that has a tremendous amount of knowledge about what happens in policing in America. Pamela, did you have another question? Did you want to follow?
Well, I did, because I was thinking as Norm was talking about the profile of the police officer. We think about profiling criminals, but the profile of the police officer, and I understand the notion of being in the family, and people have similar values and ways of seeing the world. How does the aggression, let's say, of the police officer then go into his family? I mean, so you have the police officer thinking the person of color is dangerous, but then you hear about the domestic violence situation within his own family. I mean, is this linked in some way in terms of the profile of some police officers?
It absolutely is linked. Police officers are used to having their way, not necessarily with their bosses, in the organization, which creates a very, very important source of tension in the lives of everyday police officers. Another quick digression, if you treat a police officer like a dependent or delinquent child through supervisory practices, through disciplinary procedures and so forth, if you punish them, in short, for honest mistakes rather than coaching and counseling and schooling and helping them, you're helping to create an attitude that they carry out into the streets. Mm. Well, you know, I can't really rebel effectively and openly against my sergeant, lieutenant, captain, the police chief, but I sure can against individuals that I contact on the streets. So I think what happens is they are all about expressing their authority. Now, some do that very wisely, sparingly, and just so humanly and compassionately that you want to hug them. It's just like they're not out of control, they're not yelling, they're not screaming, they're not ordering, and yet people are doing what they want them to do because they've learned how to communicate with their fellow human beings. Now, I think if we look at the link between aggression on the streets and aggression in a police officer's home, what we're looking at is a police officer who's used to having his or her way, and I'll emphasize he for the most part in talking about domestic violence. I get a lot of static when I do this, but it's important to point out that domestic violence is principally a male problem. And it starts with how we raise boys in our society, but that's another story.
Yes.
Anyway, if I'm used to having my way and I come home and my spouse or my children are defying me from my point of view, that makes for a pretty volatile situation. And we have police officers who engage in domestic violence at a higher rate than does the rest of the population. They have more to lose than the rest of the population, because if they're convicted of a domestic violence offense, thank God, that gun is taken away from them and they're stripped of their badge. And yet, even in the face of that potential threat to their careers, we still see high incidents of domestic violence. We had a police chief in the city to the south of me in Tacoma by the name of David Brame, who shot and killed his wife while he was a sitting police chief in a public parking lot in the presence of his preteen children, shot and killed himself. That's somebody who treated his spouse as property, as an appendage, if you will, to himself. His ego was wrapped up so intricately and intimately in his relationship with his wife that I don't think he ever saw her as a true, independent human being, somebody worthy of the love that he purported to have for her. So he commits this unspeakable crime. Now, how is it that a police officer could do something like that? And I think, once again, we need to look at maleness, and we need to look at the cop culture.
And just I know that Doug has much more to say, and I'm just jumping in one more time quickly. What I'm hearing from you, and I think that this is very, very true, is this is a complicated issue. I mean, obviously, there's not one way to fix this. This is a very deep-rooted issue that manifests in many different ways.
It certainly does. But let's focus for a moment, if we may, on the police culture and how it affected what went on in Ferguson. We had a controversial shooting. I'm not prepared to answer the question what happened there. We don't know yet, and it may be a little while before we actually know. I've always been a very strong believer that you do fact-finding before concluding. And that does mean that we need to let a homicide investigation, an internal affairs investigation, and a Department of Justice investigation complete the work of those, the investigators to complete the work of those investigations. We do know that an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by a white police officer. That is not the first time that's happened in this country, and sadly, it will not be the last time. And I think we need to look at what led up to that in the mind and the heart of the police officer. We need to look at the culture, and we need to look at fear, which we really haven't talked about yet. It is my belief that white cops, particularly those who are a product of a white upbringing, exclusively if not predominantly white upbringing, very little contact or association, very few friendships, maybe even working relationships with people who are different from them, whose skin color is different. And there is a tendency, I think, when we are ignorant of others, to fear them. That's certainly true, I believe, in police work with respect to some white cops and their relationship with African Americans. I believe that the darker, the bigger the black man, the more frightened a white police officer is, if in fact he fits the profile of the kind of cops I'm talking about.
Yes.
They grow up fearing in the system. They sort of mature in the system of policing, believing that if they're going to get hurt, if they're going to get killed on the job, it's certainly not going to come from some Casper Milk Toast white person. It's going to come from a dark African-American, typically young man. And you don't ever have to use that language. You don't have to say, you know, I had a fight with a black guy. All you have to do is talk geography. In San Diego, I was at 30th and Imperial when this guy came up to me. I was at 5,000 Churchward when I saw a guy pull a gun. I was in the 4900 block of Franklin, and I saw the glint of a knife come out of this guy's waistband. You don't have to mention color. You just have to mention community. And unfortunately, throughout most of this country, and it's certainly true in Ferguson, geography as well as demography is kind of destiny. I'm now going into alien enemy territory. I'm working Logan Heights in San Diego. My badge, my gun, my conspicuously marked automobile marks me as the enemy. I get that. The people I'm looking at are the enemy. Not all of them, certainly, but I would say that those hanging on a street corner, those who are young, those who are all about challenging authority anyway, which is what people in their late teens and early 20s typically tend to do, create this really combustible set of circumstances, and it really requires patience, maturity, cultural sensitivity. It requires self-discipline. And if we don't have that, we're afraid. And I think many, many cops are afraid, and that's why they act impulsively. That's why you'll hear them barking orders or screeching orders when a much calmer, more confident approach will have the desired effect. And they provoke. Then you put them in military uniforms and use tear gas, as we did in my city in 1999. And God forbid you put them on the end of a leash that has a snarling, lunging German Shepherd police dog held at bay by a white police officer facing a young black crowd. That's a throwback to Birmingham Bull Connor in the 1960s. It's an appalling image.
Yes.
And operationally, it's very stupid as well. But just the imagery, the iconography of a white cop, in effect, sticking a police dog on young African Americans is something I thought I'd never see again in a city in this country.
Yeah, let me just bring up, I want to go back. It's not really a changing of the subject at all here. It's really talking about degrees of violence that are a possibility now that didn't used to be. When one of the scary things for me on watching what was happening in Ferguson on the television was the fact that they had an officer sitting with a rifle, probably an automatic weapon, on top of a tripod, willing to take that action, which to me is crazy. In that situation, I mean, it's like mass murder. So, and in your book or in your article, Nothing Works in Ferguson, to shorten it up, you say, it may be too late to have prevented violence in Ferguson, but the community and others like it must come together now and make immediate changes to establish a baseline of behavior for law enforcement to abide by today and to build upon for the future. And what I see is this tendency to get worse, more militarization of the police, more dehumanization on both sides. And, of course, if the police are going to have automatic weapons, then I guess I need an Uzi as a young black man to survive. So how do we bring about this, changing this baseline? The bobbies in Great Britain didn't even carry weapons until a few years ago.
And many of them still don't. You have to have special authorization to actually carry a weapon for the most part throughout the United Kingdom, certainly in England. But, you know, going back to that image that you just described, Doug, that was a sniper rifle sitting atop an MRAP, which is a mine-resistant, ambush-protected, very tall piece of rolling stock. And here we have sitting on top of it in military garb a sniper who happens to be a police officer. You know, from what I could tell, he was not training it at the crowd, but he might as well have been. You know, I was on a CNN program a couple of weeks ago, and a fellow guest was a recently retired military officer, and he was asked this question about the images coming out of Ferguson, and he said, you know, the host asked him, we heard that even the soldiers in Iraq didn't have the kind of equipment that we're seeing on city streets today in America. And his response was, we had that equipment, but what we didn't do is misuse it. And he raised, I think, a critical point. There are times and places and circumstances that justify military-looking equipment and weaponry. I think of Columbine. I think of Sandy Hook. I think of the McDonald's massacre. I was present in the immediate aftermath of that mass killing back in 1984 in San Diego. This was in the community of San Ysidro, right at the Mexican border. And James Huberty, armed with an arsenal, walked into that iconic fast food joint and started shooting up the place. He killed 20 children, men, and women before our sniper, a SWAT officer, was able to take him out. And raised in the wake of that incident was the question, could we have at least reduced the carnage if we had been able to get to him earlier? He was popping rounds at our police officers as they approached, trying to find cover as they advanced on the McDonald's. I couldn't help shaking the thought that if we had had something like an armored personnel carrier, we could have driven a truckload of SWAT officers up to or maybe even through the door of the McDonald's and either captured or killed James Huberty before he killed another child. And our answer to that was, we'll never really know, but maybe. And so there is a time and a place for armed and barricaded suspects with hostages, for active shooter incidents, for a Columbine, for example, when you can't just put a hatless, helmetless, unprotected police officer with a sidearm into a situation like that and expect anything but a predictable outcome. So when I saw that in Ferguson, a sniper in the midst of a crowd, I felt the same thing that this Army officer said, which is, you would never do that. Snipers are precision shooters. Their purpose is to be out of sight. They shouldn't even be visible. Now, he's talking military tactics. What we looked at in Ferguson and getting finally, I apologize, Doug, I tend to get wrapped up in these topics. What we saw really was an absolutely predictable result of the advancing militarization of American law enforcement.
Let me interrupt you, Norman. Yeah. We have a caller, and I'd like to take this call, get the community involved here.
Please.
Bring him up on the air. Morrow, you're on the air. Are you there? Oops, wait a minute. He's there. Morrow, you're on the air.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Okay. I live in Shasta County, and this is kind of an announcement to all our citizens here. A friend of mine who is a ex-Vietnam helicopter pilot is doing research into what our county has been getting from the federal government. And so far he found that we received 77 assault rifles. And I believe that's more than we have in deputies. And normally I would think that just a SWAT team would carry something like that. But to think that there could be an entire police force.
You're fading out, Marl.
You know, an entire police force with their assault rifles, plus whatever volunteers they bring up. Why would they need 77 assault rifles?
Yeah, and on top of that, we have in Shasta County probably only about a population of 1% African Americans, and I think even smaller. We have very few minorities here, but yeah, why the buildup, Norm, at all the local police levels of these arsenals, basically?
It is, in my judgment, a mindless buildup of these arsenals. And your caller, I think, was spot on in saying, I can get it for SWAT. I understand that. Most people do. But what we really have a difficult time with is tiny rural police departments across this country have acquired in surplus Department of Defense military equipment millions of dollars, literally. I mean, two and three and one officer departments having acquired millions of dollars in military equipment, surplus equipment. Some of it, incidentally, new. But the question is why? And where was the public? Where were the people when in their name these acquisitive law enforcement agencies are petitioning their government and receiving at no cost other than shipping and presumably whatever they choose to spend on maintenance, to their local jurisdictions? These are huge issues for the people to decide. And I am so pleased to hear that in Shasta County you've got activists who are questioning and challenging this really mindless program. They're doing it, I think, in part because it's there. They somehow believe there is a free lunch. There's not. There are no legitimate strings attached to this property. The federal government doesn't demand or require training in this equipment. They simply parcel it out. Now, fortunately, one of the very small glimmers of hope coming out of Ferguson is that members of Congress are now appalled at what they saw on the streets of that, you know, middle of America city. So they're now talking about hearings, and we can only hope that that their constituents will place enough pressure on them to put an end to this mindlessness.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Co-hosting today is Pamela Spoto. Our guest is Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle and author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. We're talking about the militarization of U.S. law enforcement and ongoing police violence and bigotry. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. And we have another caller, so let me take this next caller and see what he has to say. Rocky, you're on the air.
Good morning, Doug. I appreciate your program, and thank you for being on, Norm.
Thank you.
My question is, you see all of these police encounters where they shoot, you know, empty a clip, pop in another clip, and just overwhelming firepower. And I'm used to be an avid hunter and a combat vet, and I cannot see the sanity in this, the overwhelming firepower that they do when they have an encounter. And is this a product of their training or a product of lack of training? It just doesn't make sense when they go ahead.
I'm sorry, Rocky. Go ahead, please.
When they could wound a suspect and put him out of commission and take him alive, instead, I mean, it's just it's overwhelming what they're doing, you know? Like, some of these people are getting shot 15, 20 times. Anyway, I'll take your answer off the line.
Thank you, Rocky.
Okay. You raised, I think, the really critical question, is this part of their training or is it a product of no training? And the answer is every police officer has been trained. The question ultimately is how and how effectively has that officer been trained? When I became a cop, this is ancient history, of course, in 1966 in San Diego, we were taught in the police academy, you shoot to kill. And there was no ambiguity about that. You shoot to kill the person. You've aimed your service revolver, no semi-automatics in those days, at the 10 ring, and you open fire, and you shoot to kill. We were disabused of that kind of mentality and that kind of training somewhat gradually over the years, and certainly into the 70s and 80s, the direction changed. You shoot to stop the threat. Now, if there's an alternative to lethal force, you're expected and really, I think, morally required to use that alternative, that less than lethal force. It might be a taser. It might be pepper spray. It might be your baton. It might be boxing. It might be certain aspects of certain of the martial arts. But there are defensive tactics that you can use. But if you do believe, and a reasonable officer, this is the test, any other reasonable officer would believe the same, that you are about to be killed or suffer great bodily injury, or that that's about to happen to another innocent person, you are authorized to use lethal force. You are expected by training throughout most of this country to simply end the threat. In other words, if the person advancing on you has an edged weapon, it might be a baseball bat, it might be a knife, it might be a machete, any one of which could kill you, you are authorized to use lethal force, but the moment that threat is over, that's the time that the trigger finger gets indexed. In other words, it's taken out of the trigger guard and off the trigger. That doesn't mean, and incidentally, it's the telling of these kinds of stories that I'm about to mention that cause police officers to pump multiple rounds into people. You hear about somebody who was shot in the chest or somebody who was shot in the head continuing to return fire. It's reasonable to tell a police officer, shoot till that threat is gone. But one of the things that does happen in a shooting incident, of course, and I'm sure, Rocky, with your background and experience can relate to this, is if you perceive that the threat is still real and still active, you're probably going to be pulling the trigger again and again. I do hear from time to time people say, well, why didn't you shoot him in the leg? Why didn't you shoot him why didn't you shoot the gun out of their hand? Now, of course, we're talking about an unarmed man in Ferguson. But I just have to say that's silly. It really is.
We have another caller. A lot of people are interested in what you have to say. So we got another caller. I like to take the callers because a lot of times they introduce things we hadn't even thought of. So
you bet.
Let me take this caller. Dickie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Doug. Thanks again for your show. Like your guest, I was living in San Diego back in the 70s, and I was an activist there and had quite a number of less-than-friendly run-ins with police officers in the run-of-the-mill leafleting or posting flyers. And one of the things we learned was that a lot of the officers that were being hired at that time were recently returned Vietnam vets. And I'm wondering if that's a factor now, that because these guys were so edgy.
Yeah, I think it is a factor. I've written in my book, and I firmly believe that there are some ex-military who bring to the job maturity and self-confidence and self-discipline that you really need as a police officer. But we also have the other kind, who cannot turn off what they've experienced halfway around the world.
That's what I remember. Yeah,
it comes back to, it's valuable to generalize, it's not valuable to stereotype. And so
I understand.
I think you treat each individual as an individual, good candidate, bad candidate. Don't hire the bad one.
Are there a lot of officers being hired who are recently returned vets at this point in time, do you know?
Yes, there across are. The country. In fact, if you did not hire them, you wouldn't, in fact, if you did not hire sufficient numbers of them, you wouldn't have police forces.
Okay, well, thanks for the answer.
Thanks,
yeah, thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Dickie.
Bye.
I do have another question. I have a little preface to it because you're so full of great information, and as I'm listening to you, all these ideas and questions come up. And when I'm teaching African American literature, I mean, we talk about various unarmed African Americans who have been killed, because we talk about the relationship between police and the African American community, and talking about shooting and multiple shots. And I mean, one of the most infamous cases is Amadou Diallo. I mean, songs were made out of 41 shots were fired. He had no gun. He was innocent. You know, it just it's really rather amazing to me. Or Oscar Grant, who is restrained in the Bay Area, and the officer thinks he's getting his taser, but shoots him, you know, in the head with a gun. You know, it's that's mind-boggling to me. But that being said, you know, and I wholeheartedly agree with you that we need to change the culture of policing. It's a systemic issue. The training, what is being trained, what officers tell other officers, and this notion of better trained officers who have maturity and patience and intelligence and calmness, you know, versus the fear that they carry, and understandably so. My thought, though, is it doesn't seem like we're moving in that direction. You know, the prison industrial complex is getting bigger and bigger. Profit, you know, profits, money is part of that. And then the militarization of the police. I think, and maybe I'm wrong, is that we have a culture of violence across the board. We think violence is a solution. We see that in our foreign policy. We see that in the police. And I would like to think that this can be changed. But it just seems like it's moving full steam ahead for allegedly violent solutions to problems, rather than this calmness, this thought, thinking out, this intelligent responses. Well, I mean, can you give me hope?
yes, I can give you hope.
Oh, good.
you know, I thought in my time, my quick preamble, the drug war has caused far more harm than good. It's time to end it. It's
yes.
The source of much of the militarization. It's the source of much of the tension between white cops and African-American communities. It has destroyed families. We've incarcerated tens of millions of American citizens for low-level, nonviolent drug offenses.
Yes.
We need to end that drug war, and overnight, almost overnight, we will begin to see an improvement in the relationship between police and community.
Mm.
That said, I think I used to say, well, the first to fall will be marijuana. We'll legalize marijuana. Well, I said in my earlier speeches, it's not going to happen in my lifetime, but it'll happen. Well, I'm still kicking, and two states, including the one in which I live, have legalized marijuana, and it's going to happen very quickly across this country. That's a real positive step in the right direction.
Yes.
So there's hope that through community activism, political activism, through organizing and mobilizing. The gentleman earlier was talking about leafleting and handing out pamphlets to people. Whatever methods that we can use to show the voice of the American people in this conversation is the extent to which we can have hope. Because don't expect the government to do it. Don't expect the institutions, the prison industrial complex, for example, to do it. Ain't going to happen.
Yes.
But the people can make it happen.
Well, we have one more of the people on the phone. So let's take this call. Pat, you're on the air.
Uh-oh.
Pat, are you there?
Oh.
You're on the air.
Good morning, Doug and Pam.
Good morning.
And Mr. Norm, I just have a question. You guys always keep saying that we do cultural diversity training. So I'd just like to know, what is law enforcement cultural diversity training consist of?
The short answer is that in both San Diego and in Seattle, we drew people from the community who had expertise in providing cultural competence, as we called it at the time, training to police officers. We went through a selection process where we interviewed all kinds of potential providers of this training, picked out people who we thought would most effectively relate to police officers, get their attention, and change hearts and minds. And as I said, I didn't say this, but I saw some real sort of life-changing moments, aha moments for some people in that class. But it's not long enough. It's not reinforced enough in the culture once police officers get out of the academy or return to their assignments out of in-service training. So it's important, but it's not enough.
Can I interject something just very quickly here? Both Doug Bennett, myself, and Pat Sansom sat on a citizens' oversight committee for police, well, law enforcing in Shasta County. And this was what, Doug, maybe 8 years ago, 10 years ago. And I remember we would have meetings with the police chief and the sheriff. But I remember sitting across from the police chief at that time, and I remember distinctly his icy blue eyes. And I was telling him experiences that my African-American students would have driving to school, and there was no emotion. It was like, that's just a story. That's just anecdotal. That has no, I mean, that's how I felt I was received. And I don't know, Doug, would you agree that that not too much happened from our...
Yeah, but I want to go back to Pat because she's still on the line. I want to see if she's satisfied with that answer.
Well, I'm not really, because it's so hard to talk about race and dealing with the chief of police and our law enforcement up in this area. We hate to discuss race relations. You know, it's really not a problem. We do so much under the rug situations here, and our new chief, you know, is pro-military, and it's frightening not only for people of color. It's frightening for society as a whole. That it looks like it's more like it's a war on the citizens. Like we're in Afghanistan, Palestine. It's just really sad where law enforcement is today.
I could not agree with you more, and I can't speak to this particular chief and his icy blue eyes, but what I can tell you is I don't know what it's going to take. I have some ideas, but I don't know really what it's going to take to get police officers who put on their game, you know, their game day masks, who just for whatever reason cannot relate on a human level with a person sitting across from them. And that has to happen if we're to build partnerships. I think the people, the police, it drives me crazy. The people in America are being policed by too many police departments and too many police officers who believe we're the cops and you're not. We will decide what we're going to do and how and when and if we're going to do it. The police, the people in America do not belong to the police. The police belong to the people. And if we can sort of get that one basic premise, planted, the seeds of that planted within the law enforcement culture, we'll begin to see police work that has become more satisfying to the people doing it and safer for the people doing it, to the benefit of the community, of course.
Okay, Pat, did you have anything else to add? We only have about four more minutes in the show.
Okay, I just have one more thing. And when we say law enforcement is to protect and serve, well, when it comes to people of Caucasian race, law enforcement is really there to protect and serve. But when it comes to our community, we have a lot of distrust and fear. We don't like to talk about the distrust and fear. We'll get one person from the Afro-American community and pretend like this is the speaking head for this community. Mm-hmm. But until law enforcement reach out and speak within the whole community to say that we're here to protect and serve you, that's where the change is going to come. And it's not mm-hmm. only going to change with law enforcement. It needs to go right on into your courtroom mm-hmm. because you have law enforcement who will write a police report, get up on the witness stand, and tell an absolutely lie and never be charged with perjury. So then the judges, you know, so it won't just take putting a few Afro-Americans on your law enforcement. It's going to take a lot of change, and that wouldn't consist of what's going on in the courthouse, too, with those judges, because when we as people of color go in to testify, we're already perceived as a thug, and then there is no representation of us in the courtroom.
Yeah, we have,
I've seen that throughout my career, and I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, we have just a little less than 4 minutes. And the big question here that we haven't gotten to, and I'm going to give this rest of the show to you, Norm, is what specific steps can the community take to make this change happen?
I think the community can organize itself, mobilize itself, create a list of, you can call them demands, call them, you know, label them however you want. But it's a statement of how things should be. Here's how things are. Here's how things should be. We need to humanize our police force. We need to decriminalize our police force. We need to set rules that do not allow police officers to use chemical agents on nonviolent, non-threatening prisoners.
Yes.
We need to hide those guns. If there's a place for them, they're not in crowd control. They're in these barricaded suspects, the bank robbery, so on and so forth. And we need to, I think, probably the most important thing that we can do is insist on community participation in every aspect of policing. And I refer to policymaking, program development, crisis management, and certainly to civilian oversight. Legitimate civilian oversight. I favor subpoena power. I favor investigative powers. But the community has to want this and has to want it enough to make its collective point made. Now, in our society, you're entitled to be apathetic. That's what you choose. But I think we've seen enough damage caused by the militarization of policing and by long-standing race discrimination and bigotry to recognize that the status quo is not acceptable. We really do need to reverse it. And by getting citizen participation in every aspect of police practices, we'll begin to see that happen.
Well, ideally, we have some police officers listening today. The three of us here, Pat and Pamela and myself, have been active in the community in the past, and we see a lot of resistance in the police culture to most of those things that you're suggesting.
Yes.
But, Norm, I want to thank you very much for being on Unspun with us today. It's been informative, and it's so good to have somebody with your credentials talking about this, and so valuable for the community. So thank you very much. And well, so you got, that's a standing ovation of one we got here.
And I do want to say that was a wonderful, your information was wonderful, and you have a wonderful heart. And thank you.
Thank you very, very much. And to all of your callers, but I will tell you that I think that there is hope as a result of conversations like this. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And goodbye, Norm.
Goodbye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Well, that was Norm Stamper. You've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Pamela Spoto has co-hosted with me today. And, well, we're out of time. Thanks for listening.
This is Community
Radio. KKRN 88.5 FM.
KKRN Bella Vista 88.5 on your FM dial.